This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In 1940, a young radio engineer met Albert Einstein, who was interested in his work and encouraged him to record and document all the sounds of the world to make an encyclopedia of sound. And as unlikely as it might seem, that's exactly what Moses Ash set out to do.
When I'm gone, Molly, don't you grieve. When I'm gone, Molly, don't you grieve. When I'm gone, Molly, don't you grieve. And I told her, don't you grieve out of me. I just got my army cold. I'm going to...
Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby.
Based in a tiny, overcrowded office and studio in Manhattan, Folkways under Moses Ash produced almost 2,200 records, about one a week, for more than 35 years. Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly, Pete Seeger, Mary Lou Williams, music of the Bahamas and Bali, the sounds of the civil rights movement and of North American frogs. Mo Ash's records helped fuel the folk music revival, the blues rediscoveries, and the evolution of bluegrass. He captured the music of the world's peoples and documented the history of jazz. Later in the program, a secret order to conduct secret raids on Al-Qaeda in as many as 20 countries. But first, we want to hear your stories. Do you remember the first Folkways record you heard? What's your Folkways moment? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org/talkofthenation. Richard Carlin is the author of Worlds of Sound, the story of Smithsonian Folkways. He joins us today from our bureau in New York. Richard Carlin, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And I should say we're going to have some music later. It wouldn't be a show about Folkways records if we didn't have some music on the program. But I wanted, was there a Folkways moment for you, Richard Carlin?
Well, I think there were several. It started, I guess, when I was 12 years old, when I first heard Elizabeth Cotton in concert. She came to the town where I lived, actually accompanied by Mike Seeger, who I think is going to be on the show a little later.
You think correctly.
And I actually went to New York City on the bus to buy a copy of her record because I couldn't get it at my hometown, and went up to the Folkways offices, which at that time were just about the size of a closet. Walked in, and there was this gruff old man there who, for some reason or another, I immediately recognized as Moses Ash. I guess I had read about him or heard about him, and... he told me I had to go to Sam Goody to buy a record. He wouldn't sell me a record, but that memory stuck with me. And from then on, I was a Folkways acolyte, I guess you could say.
Later, you came back from Britain with recordings of concertina players, mm-hmm. and got Mo Ash to release a record.
Well, again, you know, the great thing about Folkways was their address was always right there on the label, so you didn't have to know him. You could just send a tape in, and that's what I did. And about 6 months after I sent it in, I got tired of waiting. So I again went up to the office, took the bus in and said, "Where's my tapes?" And Mo kind of looked at me like I was crazy. But then he said, no, this is something I want to put out. So from then on, for about 5 or 6 years, he put everything out that I brought to him, and it was really a great learning experience.
Obviously, of all those hundreds and hundreds, thousands of records, he produced few of them himself. He produced a lot of them himself, but he had to have a lot of help, too. And part of the fascinating part of your book is all of the different collaborators who worked with him and worked with him to bring out these sequences of records, everything from Sam Charters, who did so much in terms of the blues revival. We'll be talking with Mike Seeger later about the bluegrass change, you know, publicizing bluegrass music, but also eccentrics, not unlike Mo Ash himself, who were interested in things like the sounds of frogs and railroad engines.
Yeah, he was highly tolerant of eccentric people. He really was. He felt that everyone should have their voice heard and was very sympathetic to those that he felt were shut out of traditional channels. So people like Harry Smith, who edited the Anthology of American Folk Music, Vinton White, who's the man who chased steam engines, and sometimes waiting till 2 or 3 in the morning by the side of a track to record one as it passed by.
The picture you describe of him waiting there in the middle of the night in Nebraska or Wyoming for the train to go by with his wife patiently knitting while she was there with him.
Yes, and Harold Corlander, of course, one of the first great what we call today ethnomusicologists, who recorded in Haiti. He actually had to get a special permit to record Haitian drums because it was at that time against the law for natives to play that music. So it's just a number of visionary people.
Tony Schwartz, who, of course, right. Famous for making the Daisy spot during the Goldwater Johnson campaign
and
in
remarkably,
1964.
Yes, and remarkably, Tony was agoraphobic, and yet he's famous for documenting the world of New York City and sound.
New York 19, New York. Yes, indeed. Right. Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We're talking with Richard Carlin, the author of Worlds of Sound, the story of Smithsonian folkways. And let's see if we can begin with Gordon. Gordon with us from Columbus in Ohio.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was 19, went to college in 1960, and then sort of the middle of my freshman year, I came home, and I had gone to a school down south, and my friend had gone to, best friend had gone to Swarthmore, and he sat me down in his living room. First, he played the first Joan Baez album, but then got into folkways, Pete Seeger's love songs for friends and foes, and I was a total convert to folk music, then dropped rock and roll, rhythm and blues, cold. And for many years, listened to a lot of folkways, Ledbetter, Gene Ritchie, a bunch of those. And, you know, eventually when the Beatles came along, I actually got interested in rock and roll again.
Some of that rock and roll wasn't too bad. But I think Gordon tells a familiar story. And when he refers to Ledbetter, of course, Hughie Ledbetter, also known as Leadbelly.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, Moe. Not only did he put the records out, but he kept them in print. And what that meant was that Woody Guthrie, for example, who Moe recorded extensively in the 40s and early 50s, was unable to perform. He was beginning to suffer from the first stages of Huntington's chorea, the terrible disease that took his life. But Moe kept those records in print. And so that really Woody Guthrie wouldn't have been heard if it weren't for Moe, and a young man in Hibbing, Minnesota named Bob Dylan wouldn't have been influenced to come to New York to find him. So, and also when you look in the actual archives and see the royalty statements, it's not like these records were selling thousands of copies. I think Woody Guthrie's initial albums sold in the tens. And so it just simply was Moe's feeling that this music deserved to be heard, even if it was unpopular. Certainly the same thing was true for Pete Seeger, who was blacklisted.
Yeah, fascinating connection that, of course, Hughie Ledbetter's song Goodnight Irene became a number one hit for the Weavers, including Pete Seeger, 6 months after Hughie Ledbetter's death. And then, of course, that group had to break up under the influence of the Red Scares.
Right, right. And Pete tells a wonderful story of how he could be just walking in New York City, think of a song, run up to the Folkway studio, take out his banjo, record it, and 10 minutes later be back on the street walking again. And that was that kind of open studio, and open not only in terms of the door being open, but open to all kinds of people. I mean, you have to understand, at that time, it was unusual for African-American folk singers, other non-commercial artists to be able to even get in the door of a record label. And it was doubly unusual for them to be able to go into a studio and record whatever they wanted. Moe never interfered. Mary Lou Williams famously said, if you just burped, Moe would record it.
Of course, you wouldn't get the royalty payments for your burp either.
But, Well, that's true. I don't know.
Gordon, thanks very much for the phone
call.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Eddie. Eddie's with us from Rock Island in Illinois.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I remember the first time I ever heard a Folkways record, and it was, I'm still at college at Augustana College. I'm a senior now, but it was my freshman year fall term, and I was sitting there doing nothing, and I just discovered a recent, like, freshman musicology, and looking through the catalog in the music library, there was the entire collection of Folkways records. And I just started listening to them, and for almost an entire year, that's all I did whenever I was working, was just listen to Folkways records.
And it's something of an education, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, and it's something that I found was kind of lacking. It's just, I put myself in his shoes, and just thinking about that idea of everyone's voice needs to be heard. Just think about how much effort goes into a song and how much of, like, a person's spirit goes into that when they're playing or when they're composing or anything like that. It really is one of the saddest things I think could happen is for someone's music to not be documented or not be listened to again, because it's just that much of an emotional output for them, and it really does show something about the person and the culture and everything about that.
Thanks very much for the call, Eddie. Appreciate it. And again, Eddie's not alone. And it speaks to the importance, Richard Carlin. We call it, your book is about Folkways, the Smithsonian Folkways. Shortly after his death, the entire catalog of Folkways record was transferred to the Smithsonian Institution here in Washington, D.C., and is kept alive and is kept. It's not a dead collection. It's a beating collection.
Well, I think one of the most important things that Tony Seeger, the first director of the collection, did was he decided to digitize every track that was commercially released. And this was, you know, somewhat before the iPod revolution. And it really means that a college student now can go and listen to any of the tracks, the tens of thousands of tracks that are there. And Dan Sheehy, the current director, who we heard at the beginning of the program, has extended what Folkways does, particularly in partnering with people. You know, it used to be that the idea of an ethnomusicologist was you went to some strange corner of the world and recorded the people there. But now it's much more you go and teach the people there to record themselves so that the word can be spread.
We're talking about the legacy of Mo Ash and Folkways record. Tell us your Folkways moment, 800-989-8255. You can also zap us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. More with Richard Carlin in a moment, and Mike Seeger will join us to play us a song or two. So stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Richard Carlin today about his new book, Worlds of Sound, the story of Smithsonian Folkways. In it, he tells the history and the legacy of the recording company launched by Moses Ash. Do you remember the first Folkways record you heard? Tell us your Folkways moment, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org and just click on Talk of the Nation. And let's see if we can go now to Paul. Paul's with us from East Hampton in New York.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Delighted you took my call. Well, I was a 19-year-old theater school student in Montreal, and I was working my way through school as a CBC staff announcer in Montreal. In fact, I was slightly senior to the late Peter Jennings, who remained a good friend. And the station managers probably got 15 minutes on Sunday morning at 12:15. You want to do a folk music program? I said, "What are you talking about?" So I did. And the first place I went to was Folkways in Montreal, where Sam Geffen ran probably an equally tiny office. And I can still see those Folkways records with sort of the dark brown, black cardboard backing and that sort of brown labels. I can actually smell them still. that was my first exposure to folk music. And
I should probably identify Paul as Paul Hecht. Peter Jennings went on to the news business. You went into the acting business.
I did, and I'm still on the acting business. You may hear me every now and then on selected shorts if you get it. Yeah, I stayed in the business, but still love it. Still love music. I love bluegrass. I remember playing Lead Belly and all of those guys. I remember it was exactly the time that Bob Dylan was the Horrors of Horrors. Those Folkways records in that office will stay with me all the time. So it's great. It's great that you're honoring him and playing them. I'm going to enjoy listening to the rest of the program.
Thanks very much for the phone call, Paul. And there was a separate Canadian operation, but obviously connected to Folkways Records.
Well, Sam Gasser was an interesting fellow, and he tells a classic Moash story, actually, because he came to Mo as a young man. He had somehow gotten a hold of a Lead Belly record. This was very early, like 1951. And he said to Mo, hey, how come you don't have records of Canadian music? And Mo replied, as only Mo could, what are you going to do about it? And so, you know, so that's Sam Gasser became his agent. And I think produced over 200 albums, people like Jean Carillon and Alan Mills, but also all kinds of Canadian folk music. And again, it was Mo's ability to enlist others in his mission, usually for little or no payment, but simply because they believed in the cause, that really helped Folkways grow.
Mentioned Mike Seeger earlier. He joins us today from the studios of member station WVTF Radio IQ in Roanoke, Virginia. We were down there for electoral purposes about a month ago. Mike Seeger, it's a great honor to have you on the program today.
Well, thanks for asking. I'm down here in Roanoke now.
Pretty fancy digs for public radio, huh?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a great studio, and I'm in the control room here.
Well, Mike Seeger, of course, also a longtime Smithsonian Folkways artist, one of the founding members of the New Law City Ramblers. Can you play us a tune?
Sure. Richard mentioned Elizabeth Cotton, and it just happens that I thought I'd like to play a song that she's well known for and a couple of instrumentals that she played too.
So they won't know what route I'm going.
And a little bit of Wilson Rag.
Mike Seeger playing some of the songs of Elizabeth Cotton from Roanoke, Virginia, WVTF Radio IQ. Mike Seeger, I should point out your latest record, Early Southern Guitar Styles, was released last year. But what was it like working for Moash? And just tell us a little bit more about his personality.
Well, as Richard said, he was gruff, but he was also real friendly. I only heard about Moash from my folks in the early 50s, a little bit in regards to my brother recording for Folkways. And he wrote me a two-sentence letter asking me to if I'd be interested to record some Scruggs-style banjo players in the South in 1956. And he said, I could offer you $100 towards your expenses. So I recorded a whole LP of 15 banjo players, including some of the people who influenced or might have influenced Earl Scruggs, and people who learned from Earl Scruggs, for about $100, a whole LP in 1956.
And it's pretty fair to say that a whole lot of banjo players have listened to that record ever since.
I guess so. And then it wasn't too long until I got the idea, well, heck, Elizabeth Cotton is a wonderful musician. I think somebody would like to hear her. So I'd go down and visit her. And Mo would just said, oh, yeah, I'd like to put that out, and so forth and so on. And then the New Lost City Ramblers, of course, in 1958. He would love to, he just loved to give people, musicians, a voice and the control of their recordings.
And Richard Carlin, you describe in your book how those recordings really changed what we came to know as bluegrass music, because they enabled it to move out of smoky bars and into college campuses and onto different kinds of venues, onto the concert stage where it never had been before.
Well, I think people like Mike Seeger, I mean, it's such an honor to be on this program with him, because he really was instrumental through the Ramblers in his own solo work, and also his work as a folklorist, rediscovering Doc Boggs and recording Sam McGee and with his brother Kirk and Arthur Smith and all these records that came out on Folkways. There was a small group of people that would wait breathlessly as they were for them to come out. And this music did become tremendously popular in a small way, as we like to say, on college campuses, the places like Oberlin and Swarthmore, or University of Michigan, University of Chicago. And it was thanks to these oddly packaged kind of records, as sometimes the hole wasn't centered quite right in, and sometimes the liner notes were hard to read, but it was they were really mind opening and mind expanding for so many people. And again it was Mo's ability to attract people like Mike, even though he could be gruff and irascible, to do this work.
Mike, you were trying to say?
To me, his covers were... he often got first-rate artists to design mm-hmm. the covers, and he had really informative notes to go with nearly all of his LPs. I think those things were really important in the development of recorded music and sound.
Here's an email we have from Danny, who's listening in Kansas. If you record a man, he writes, you will document him for one night. If you teach him to record himself, you will have to listen to that forever. Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. This is Terry. Terry with us from Sag Harbor in Maine.
No, that's Sag Harbor, New York. Oh,
excuse me, Sag Harbor in New York. I apologize.
No, not a problem. Love your program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyhow, the first Moses Ash recording I ever saw before I heard it was See Through Red. I don't know why they made a transparent LP, but are you familiar with that?
Well, Mo would had a lot of, because he'd been in the business so long, he was able to keep his records in print, often by printing at the end of the day, and sometimes they'd been printing children's records, so some Folkways records were on yellow vinyl or red vinyl, or Mo didn't care as long as the record was there.
Phil Houston, Lead Belly, Pete Seeger, mm-hmm. and there was one, Woody Guthrie.
Yeah.
And all four of them were singing on Get Along Home, Cindy, Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
Still here. And that was 1961. And fast forward 30 years to 1991, and I got to sing on the stage of Carnegie Hall with Pete Seeger for the 100th birthday of Carnegie Hall. And it was one of my... I've never met I never did meet Mose Ash, but Pete has a lot of similar qualities. Like, he inspires people to do incredible stuff for nothing. Like Mike Seeger before was talking about the $100 album that he made. But one of my favorite stories about Pete, I was standing on 43rd Street, and we were both waiting for a bus, and a woman came up and was just totally flustered. And she was telling Pete how he changed her life, and she blurted out the most inappropriate question I've ever heard asked of Pete, and she said, what would you say your success in show business is? Pete, without skipping a beat, said, well, sincerity and spontaneity. And if you can take those two things, you've got it made in show business.
Terry, thanks very much for the phone call. And
let me finish. So I said to Pete, the woman walked away. I said, Pete, did you just make that up? He said, no, I stole it from George Burns.
Terry, thanks very much.
Take care.
We're talking about Folkways, Smithsonian Folkways Records. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mike Seeger, you got one more song for us.
All right. Just tell me when you'd like it.
Right about now.
Oh, okay. I'll grab the banjo here. I just wanted to say one more thing, that I think it's remarkable that the spirit of Folkways has gone on within Smithsonian Folkways, and that every single recording that was ever on Folkways is available online, and you can audition them if you want to download them for 99 cents. I think that's remarkable. Is there another record company that's done that?
I don't think for 99 cents, no.
Here's one of the very first pieces that I recorded for that banjo Scruggs style and three finger back in '56. Junie Scruggs, Earl's brother, came in from work one evening, and I asked him if he would record a couple of pieces for this LP. And he played Cripple Creek, one of the most durable old-time banjo tunes.
Mike Seeger with us from WVTF Radio IQ in Roanoke, Virginia. I wanted to read some of the emails we've gotten. This from Carl. I don't remember how I found this album, but I was in high school in the early 1960s when I first heard Dave Van Ronk on Folkways. I still have that album, and I still find Van Ronk as one of the high points of folk music of that or any other era. Shortly after that, I found two albums by Mimi and Richard Farina. These are unforgettable. I still listen to all my Folkways recordings. This from Susanna in Grass Valley, California. Remember the wonderful recordings they did of Native American music, too, at the New York City Library across from the Museum of Modern Art. I used to take the LPs home and listen. And this from Karen in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I grew up in rural southern Mississippi, not in a culturally deprived household, but certainly limited by what was around us. Our library was the bookmobile. My oldest sister lived in Chicago, and in the early 1950s, I spent a summer there. From the library, we got records. I was so amazed, and interestingly enough, one I was introduced to then was Miriam Makeba. I am not sure which were Folkways, but I'm pretty sure some were. Karen Popa from Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on KWGS. And Richard Carlin, the legacy of Folkways Records with the Smithsonian Institution. We just have a few seconds left, but it's going to live forever now.
Well, let's hope so. And I think nowadays, with everyone having access to iPods and other recording devices, there's no reason why everyone can't be recording and documenting their worlds. And I think that would be the real legacy that would make Mo very happy.
Richard Carlin's book is Worlds of Sound, The Story of Smithsonian Folkways. We thank him for his time today. He was in our bureau in New York. And thanks again to Mike Seeger, who was with us from WVTF and Radio IQ in Roanoke, Virginia. Coming up, when we continue, secret orders and secret commando raids into countries not at war with the United States. We'll get the details from the New York Times' Mark Mazzetti. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.